Today is Tuesday, October 31st. We're going to work on metabolism and save time for exam 3 review.
Okay, so way back in early part of Bio210, you guys probably talked about some new key terms. You probably talked about metabolism back in the early parts of Bio210 during basic chemistry. Back then, we defined it as a sum of all chemical reactions, and that's still a pretty good way to define this term. So we now know, after having gone through 211, there's a hormone that regulates your metabolic rate. What hormone is that?
Thyroid hormone.
Thyroid hormone, good. So we look at the building reactions and your breakdown reactions as being two components of metabolism. We call the building reactions dehydration synthesis or anabolic reactions. And what are you trying to accomplish when you're performing one of these anabolic reactions?
Making a polymer,
good. So in your body, you may be growing new cells, you may be making new proteins. You know, we also think about growing hair, growing skin. Anytime you're growing or building is an anabolic reaction. All right, so how is a catabolic reaction different?
Breaks down.
Yeah, so catabolic reactions are breakdown reactions. And what are we trying to accomplish here?
Making a monomer
is good. So you take a more complex polymer, you break it apart into monomers. And what is one really good process we just got through covering that is classified as a catabolic reaction?
Hydrolysis,
good. Digestion, you know, breaking down proteins, breaking down carbs. So the last chapter we just covered is a great example of catabolic or breakdown reactions.
Would that apply for bile as well?
Yeah, because you're doing, you know, bile breakdown components and the bilirubin and stuff like that. Yeah, good. So what I'd like to do is take you on a tour of our three organic compound groups. There's the main three. And then we're going to talk a little bit today about vitamins. So that'll be something new for us. Let me flip you on over to page 98. A lot of this stuff in this chapter is a great review from old Bio210 materials. Just as a way to jog our memories, we know that there are three types or classes of compounds in the carb group. So in terms of mono, di, and polysaccharides, how do they differ?
The number of
monos. Number. Good. So monosaccharides have one sugar. Disaccharides are two. Good. And then, of course, polysaccharides are
three
or more. Good. So we're looking at simple sugars as monosaccharides, things like glucose. We look at disaccharides to be, you know, sugars like sucrose. And then polysaccharides, what would you place in that category?
Starch.
Good. Glycogen. Okay. So we're just looking at more complex sugar molecules, more ability to store those energy in those bonds. Okay, so glucose is a great example of a monosaccharide. And the reason we talk about glucose so much is, well, it's our preferred fuel for making ATP energy. So glucose is certainly a sugar that can come in our food groups. We can also break down more complex polysaccharides into glucose. What is the name of the two hormones that help us to regulate blood glucose levels?
Insulin.
Good. Insulin and glucagon. Good. In fact, we can take starches and break them down into their building blocks. The breakdown process produces glucose molecules. So what would we be doing? Catabolic reactions to break down a starch or an anabolic reaction?
Catabolic,
yeah. So break them down.
Cats are losers.
Cats are losers. Yeah, that's one way to think about it. Okay, glycogen is our body's way of storing excess glucose. You know, there's a hormone that helps to store glucose in our muscles and our liver. What's the name of that hormone? What hormone stores excess glucose as glycogen in our liver and muscles? Lowers blood sugar?
Insulin.
Yep, insulin. Good. So if you happen to have a day where you haven't had a lot to eat, your body's going to burn through your glucose supplies first. And then it tacks on and attacks these glycogen supplies. Now, what is the hormone that helps break down or hydrolyze glycogen into glucose? That time it's glucagon. Yeah. So now.
Gotta put that together.
Yeah. If insulin lowers blood sugar, stores glucose as glycogen. And of course, glucagon breaks down glycogen into glucose. Yeah. Yep, sure. Insulin helps to lower blood sugar levels. It stores glucose as glycogen.
Okay, that makes sense.
It's
lowering the blood glucose, the insulin.
That's right.
And this one breaks down glucose.
Glucagon breaks down glycogen into glucose.
Yeah, thank you. So I got flip-flop real quick. It's like, wait a minute. And that makes sense. It's almost like the pair of thyroid and the couch.
Yeah.
How they work. How it is kind of like how glucagon and insulin work for glucose. So the insulin is lowering the blood glucose and it's putting it back and storing it.
That's right.
I mean, then you're glad to have glucagon. And if the glucagon is increasing the blood sugar, then that means it's pulling and breaking down that glycogen.
That's right. So let's review this. We've got insulin helps to lower blood sugar. It helps to take excess glucose out of the bloodstream. It can store the excess as glycogen. And commonplace for us to store glycogen is muscles and liver. Insulin also allows for glucose to be escorted into cells so that we can burn off and use that sugar, but the excess we're going to store for a later time. We can typically store glycogen for around, say, 3 days, and then after that time period, we're looking at needing to get that glycogen stored as fat elsewhere in the body. Okay, so I'm just going to make a note here. Insulin lowers blood glucose levels. We store that excess glucose as glycogen. And this process has a fancy name. It's called glycogenesis. Okay, and of course, genesis means what?
Making.
Yes, so this process that we're doing is called glycogenesis.
Because it's making glycogen.
Making glycogen, yeah. So let's say that on Monday morning you go by Krispy Kreme and you have yourself a dozen donuts, you're flying high on your blood sugar, and say after your blood sugar is starting to increase beyond that range, about 70 to 120 units of blood, then we start to see that the blood sugar is going to trigger the pancreas to release insulin. Insulin takes that excess blood sugar, it forces it into cells, which gives you a jittery sugar high. And it takes the excess blood sugar and it turns it into glycogen. And so you have about, say, 3 days of time that you can store that glycogen before your body transforms glycogen into what?
Fat.
Fat, right. So after about 3 days, your body says, you know, I've been holding this stuff for you, hoping you'd come back and get it. Eventually it just says, okay, this is going to be transformed into fat. All right, so let's say that Monday you had your Krispy Kreme donuts and you had the sugar high. Let's say that on Wednesday, we're in that 3-day window, right? On Wednesday, that you had a really busy day and you didn't really get a chance to eat. So body says, I need to make ATP, and my number one choice for making ATP is a monosaccharide called glucose. Good. So your body burns off available blood glucose supplies. Your range should be about 70 to 120 units in the bloodstream. You can't drop below 70 without setting off a negative feedback loop. And so at that point, your body says, okay, blood sugar levels are getting low. Let's go after the second storage capacity. Now what do we start breaking down?
Glucagon.
Well, glucagon breaks down glycogen. Okay. And then glycogen is going to basically be broken into its building blocks, which are glucose molecules. So this is Wednesday, you know, 2 days into our sugar high, and now we're able to tap into those storage forms of glycogen. Now that we're breaking down glycogen into glucose, we're performing an opposite reaction, and this one is called glycogenolysis. Okay, and a lysis suffix, what does that tell you? Breaking down, good, or split it. So we know that this relationship between glycogen and glucose is regulated by insulin and glucagon. And so this is how you lose weight. If you go over your available glucose supplies and you break down your stored forms of glycogen from your liver and muscles, then your body says, okay, now I tap into my fat and my protein supplies. And so fats and proteins can both be broken down to give you glucose. It may not be a real clean, efficient process, but if you need energy, you're going to break down what you've got. We cannot break down nucleic acids to make glucose, so we're only looking at breaking down stored supplies of fat and lean, healthy protein and turning that into glucose supplies. So you're not going to be breaking down DNA or RNA. That's not a way for us to get sugar. Okay? So if you do happen to start going after your stored fat supplies or your protein supplies, there is another hormone that specifically transforms or assists with the transformation of fats into glucose. What hormone is this? Cortisol. Good. So cortisol may in fact come in and play a role here as well. Cortisol is going to assist with the transformation of fats into glucose. Process of transforming fats into sugars. The name, our fancy name is on your worksheet, and it's called gluconeogenesis. I think probably one of the best clues there is neo, which means what? New. Yeah, and genesis, of course, is to make. And we're actually making glucose from new sources. We don't normally think of fat as a storage form of glucose, but that's how we're going to get it. We're going to break down those fatty molecules and some proteins and use that to help us have glucose. So just to repeat what we've got here, the most readily available energy supply that we can use to make ATP is glucose. That easily found sugar is circulating in our bloodstream. If you don't have enough glucose, what is the second storage supply your body will access? Glycogen. Yeah. So glycogen can be broken down then. It is basically a storage form of glucose. So we start attacking those glycogen supplies, giving ourselves glucose molecules. If you do burn through your glycogen supplies, your body then will target your fat supplies and your proteins, and those fats and proteins can be broken down to glucose as well. So that's how we lose weight. You know, if you start breaking down fat supplies, you eventually can peel off weight doing that. The vicious circle here is unfortunately that if you're breaking down fat and not burning off the glucose, what does your body restore that sugar as? glycogen, and after about 3 days, it then gets stored as fat. The way that cortisol works with Cushing's syndrome is it can break down healthy protein supplies like muscle. And then again, if you break down muscle into sugar and you don't use that sugar, instead of storing it back as muscle, how do you store it back as? Back as fat, right. So somebody with Cushing's may in fact be losing healthy muscle tissue and transforming it into fat. And believe it or not, even if you reduce your calorie intake, you can gain weight with Cushing's because of the transformation of proteins into fat supplies. So pretty interesting hormone there and the role that it plays. How about questions on page 98? That gives you a little more detail than what's written there. So let me take you a step further. When we're talking about fats, do you happen to recall the typical building blocks? There's two of them for your fat molecules.
Fatty acids and glycerol.
Fatty acids and glycerol, good. Just take a wild guess. Which one of those two do you think is going to break down into glycogen and glucose?
Glycerol.
Yeah, good choice. So the fatty acids actually don't give us sugar supply, but the glycerol, that's a good prefix to recall there, right? Glycerol can be broken down into glycogens and to glucose, and that's actually how we get sugar from fat. It's not a real clean method, but nonetheless, if you need sugar, this is how you'll get it from fats.
It can be broken down
into
what?
It can be broken down, glycerol can be first broken down into glycogen and then into glucose. Conversation on the next page. The next page talks about lipids. Okay, so we know that lipids are mostly built from building blocks of fatty acids and glycerols. And you typically have, you know, a number of hydrocarbons on the fatty acid chains. Those hydrocarbons aren't the portion that actually break down the sugars, but nonetheless, they can store a lot of energy in the hydrocarbon fatty acid chains. This glycerol head in this picture over here in blue is what helps us to break down and make those sugar molecules. You know, I want to go back to something you probably heard about at the very beginning of Bio-210. How do fats and water behave around each other? They don't mix, right? Okay. So because fats and water don't get along, we actually have to have a way for us to transport those fats through the water of your bloodstream. And what we're looking at here are called lipoproteins. They're a mixture of fats and proteins. They bind the fats in your bloodstream, and that's how the fats get transported from, say, point A to point B. Now, if you didn't have these lipoproteins for transport, you would have a difficult time transporting the fats because of that immiscibility or inability of the fats to mix with the water of your blood. On your worksheet, there's actually two types of lipoproteins. There is something called an HDL, or a high-density lipoprotein, and an LDL, or a low-density lipoprotein. Now, we oftentimes refer to these as the good and the bad. They say the H is the helpful one and the L is the lousy one. Okay, so I'd like to explain why one is considered to be a helpful lipoprotein and one is not. So HDLs, you'll notice, carry cholesterol to the liver to be included in bile. So when bile is ejected from your liver or gallbladder, where does that bile go?
Out the body.
Out the body, yeah. So basically, the destination for this cholesterol that's being included in bile is going with poop, right? It's leaving. So it's a basic dump mechanism for us to get rid of cholesterol. HDLs are the ones that assist with getting rid of that cholesterol. Take it to the liver, let it be included in bile, get rid of that cholesterol. The LDLs, however, transport cholesterol away from our heart toward the peripheral organs, down toward your legs, out toward your arms. And in doing so, they may lose some of those triglycerides that they're transporting, and those triglycerides get stuck in your arteries. And when they get stuck in the arteries, they can cause inflammation. Inflammation leads to plaque formations and hardening of the vessels. Therefore, we consider LDLs to be bad because their job is to transport those lipoproteins and those triglycerides away from our heart toward our peripheral organs. So they increase our chances of cardiovascular disease. Of course, it has to be loud, right?
And then, HDLs can, go through and pick up the triglycerides that have been, dropped off in the arteries or whatever?
They may be able to.
They can help clear it out?
Yeah, they can help clear it out. Their job is to help bring them to the liver to get rid of them. So yeah, that could be a possibility. So if any of you have ever had a blood test done or looked at blood tests, you probably realize that the levels of HDL should be higher than LDLs because the ratio needs to be such that you transport those cholesterols to the liver to get rid of them. And you don't necessarily want more LDLs because that means the triglycerides are traveling where? Out to the body, out to the cells. And that's where you have a chance of losing them in the bloodstream and then causing inflammation and, plaques to form. So, the interesting thing about cholesterol is this. You have to get that door too. Please alternate doors. A few years ago on TV, they had a commercial for a medication that lowered your cholesterol. And if you happen to see that commercial, they said that cholesterol comes from two sources, from your food and from your family. And the point is accurate. About 85% of the cholesterol in your body comes from your own genetic makeup. So that means that, a lot of us may simply be doomed genetically to produce a lot of cholesterol. So you can alter your diet. You can eat lettuce all day long, and 85% of your cholesterol is genetically predetermined. 15% of your cholesterol is what you get from diet. So, you can limit your intake of fatty foods. Red meat is a good source of cholesterol. Cheeses, things of that sort. Animal meats have great sources of cholesterol. So if you're already running at a high risk of having high cholesterol, then they say that, your diet changes can assist, but may not be enough to lower your cholesterol to the levels that give you a healthy cardiovascular system. So, maybe in years to come, we will see ways to genetically manipulate that and just make less cholesterol than we need. All right. So we've talked about this. We know that fats can be broken down through gluconeogenesis. What is the product? What are we making by way of gluconeogenesis? Glucose, good. And which portion of the fat can we use to make glucose? Glycerol, good. So the glycerol head is the only portion that actually gives us a direct supply of sugar. So the process of turning fats into sugar is a rather complicated mess, one that we're not going to go into here. It's a lot of chemistry involved. But on your worksheet, I did want to draw your attention down there near the bottom. You'll notice something called beta oxidation under fat catabolism, which is fat breakdown. This fancy picture of chemistry is beta oxidation, and ultimately what we're making is, we're stripping down those fat molecules so that we can break them down into other products. You'll notice there that one of the byproducts of this is something called ketosis. And during ketosis, what we make from beta oxidation is ketone bodies. Now, those ketone bodies can build up in your bloodstream, and if they do build up, they actually break down and release acid. And if that happens, we say that you have now ketoacidosis. All right, so if you've heard of acidosis before, what impact does that have on your respiratory system? Hyperventilation, right. So if you go into ketoacidosis, you may hyperventilate as a response. It's a way to fix that problem. So with ketoacidosis, you've got ketone bodies present in your bloodstream, and it indicates one of two things. If you're dieting and you're trying to lose weight, what do most people do to lose weight?
Cut sugars.
Cut sugars.
Drink water.
Exercise.
And cut the amount of calories intake.
Good. So if you cut calories, you cut sugars, if you exercise, combine all those together, you're going to be using more energy than you're taking in from the foods that you eat. And if you're using more energy, you burn through your glucose, you burn through your glycogen supplies, and now you start on your fat supplies. And when you start burning off those fat supplies, that's when we start seeing a big breakdown in those ketone bodies that are present in your bloodstream. So if you want to know that you're effectively losing weight, then you can use a urinalysis strip, pee on it, and see if it's positive for ketone bodies. And so ketone bodies can indicate for a person who's trying to lose weight that, yeah, you're burning off the fat supplies, and that's ultimately your goal, is to burn off that fat. Now, there's another person that may want to be cautious about their ketone bodies, and that is a person who has diabetes mellitus. Diabetes means that we've got a problem regulating which hormone?
Insulin.
So if not enough insulin is being produced and the pancreas is failing as a regulatory center, then the body may not realize that blood sugar is already high. And so the body may break down more fats to increase blood sugar, and in doing so, breaking down fats produces what?
Glucose
and a byproduct known as?
Ketones,
yeah. So a diabetic may also experience ketoacidosis. It tends to run more in type 1 diabetes than in type 2, but nonetheless, we're looking at ketone bodies being another issue for diabetes. So ketoacidosis basically is fat metabolism. It's just a dirty little byproduct to produce those ketone bodies, and yet can cause an acidification of your bloodstream.
Is that what causes
diabetes? It is. Yep, sure is. Like that acetone odor that they've got.
Yeah, what else? What are the other symptoms of that if they have high keto? Like besides bad breath, like what if
they smell very fruity, they don't feel good, they're very weak? Don't their kidneys start like failing or something?
Like, if that's continual, yeah. They may be hot and dry. Rather than cold and clammy. Cold and clammy indicates a low blood sugar. Hot and dry may indicate a high blood sugar.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, yeah, that fruity breath is probably one of the best indicators of ketoacidosis in a diabetic. All right, and then down at the very last line there, the respiratory system would respond by doing what to your respiration rate? Yeah, if you're in ketoacidosis, you will hyperventilate. So if you've never smelled ketoacidosis on someone's breath, they describe it as a combination of fingernail polish remover, which is acetone, and like a fruity smell, like fruit juice. And once you smell it on someone's breath, it's an unforgettable odor. It doesn't smell like something that should be coming out of your body. It's a very chemical type odor, and it really does smell like a mixture of alcohol or acetone and fruit juice. Very odd odor. I imagine so. And then they act disoriented when they've got this, and so that further reinforces thinking they're, drunk. I've heard of cases where somebody's been pulled over driving and they thought the person was drunk, and lo and behold, it was diabetic problems. Yeah. Just a little bit on proteins. That's over on page 90, or rather 100.
Amino acids.
Good. So we can do protein synthesis, which is an anabolic reaction, and create more complex structures. We can also break down proteins through catabolic reactions and use those amino acids to build other things. There's about 20 amino acids that make up all the proteins on Earth. And in our bodies, 8 of those are considered to be essential amino acids. And we have to get those from the foods that we eat. These are listed on the left. You don't have to know any of the ones on the list. I just thought I would show them to you. But if you are a vegetarian, you can get the combination of 8 essentials from a diet that includes things like rice and beans, that has a great source of those 8 essentials. People who eat animal meat, you know, eggs and things of that sort, do get the combination of 8 essentials with no problem. But, you know, we have to be a little more mindful when we're consuming a more plant-based diet. We can also make glucose from breaking down proteins, but I wanted to show you this. They're just using one example here. This is serine, one of the 20 amino acids that make up proteins. And when you break down an amino acid, you'll notice that we're taking off an ammonia molecule. All right, so how do you get rid of that ammonia molecule? What smells like ammonia?
Pee.
Pee, yeah. So that's how you get rid of the breakdown waste products from protein catabolism. You get rid of that ammonia in your urine. Okay, so ultimately, by taking away that ammonia molecule, we actually can create glycogen, and then we know that glycogen breaks down to form glucose. So this is how you use a protein to create sugars. So, you know, we're breaking down proteins all day, every day. That's why urine will have a characteristic ammonia smell, especially the longer that it sits. Pretty cool stuff. Kind of figure out where everything comes from, right? All right, so down into the bottom of your page, just a little bit there on metabolic syndrome, which is kind of a catch-all term for things going on in the body. And you'll notice some symptoms there like obesity, high blood pressure, elevated blood glucose, high blood triglycerides, and so forth. What kinds of things do you think these are risk factors for the further development of?
Diabetes,
that works.
Heart disease,
that works. Good. So someone whose blood test reveals those kinds of elevated factors are definitely going to have an increased risk for things like diabetes mellitus and heart disease. All right, so last page here for us is a little bit on vitamins. Now, we've already talked a little bit about vitamins back with the large intestine. The 4 fat-soluble vitamins are what? Yeah, A, D, E, and K. Sometimes they're called the ADEC vitamins. Those are fat-soluble. The B and C vitamins are considered to be water-soluble. We did talk about B and K being made by your large intestine. And we also know that D can be made by our skin in response to exposure to UV radiation. So we can make a handful of vitamins, but most of these we get through, say, food and maybe an electrolyte-rich drink, but mostly it's just food that we're looking at. A lot of these vitamins work as coenzymes. That means they assist an enzyme with its job. You know, in general, we've talked about enzymes as being those chemicals that help to speed up a chemical reaction. And those reactions may be to build or break down. So we're looking at these being involved on a chemical reaction level in our bodies. I did want to mention that if you consume A, D, E, and K vitamins, they can be stored in your fatty tissues because they are fat soluble. Your liver can also store the ADEC vitamins because it too has a capability of storing fatty supplies. So we do tend to see, if you take in excess levels of the ADEC vitamins, a possibility for forming something called hypervitaminosis. It is rare for someone to have a deficiency of the A, D, E, and K vitamins. Why is that? You're storing fat, yeah. So it's unlikely that you're going to have a complete deficiency in one of these 4 categories. I thought I'd take you on a tour of the ADEC vitamins first. We know that vitamin A is also known as beta-carotene. What kind of foods are great sources of beta-carotene?
Carrots.
Yeah, carrots, squash, pumpkin,
yellow peppers.
So yellow, orange foods are great sources of vitamin A, beta carotene. We've always heard eat your carrots are good for your eyes, right? So if you don't like carrots, of course, there's other yellow, orange vegetables out there. We know that vitamin A actually helps the rods in your eyes reset after exposure to light. If you've ever been driving at night and felt blinded by oncoming headlights, you know, what's happening is if somebody flashes lights in your eyes, whether it's a flash bulb from a camera or bright lights from driving down a road, that has to allow time for those rods to reset to be able to see again. So for a temporary time period, you're a little bit blinded by that flash of light. And that's where vitamin A comes into play. It helps us to reset those rods back so that we can focus and see once more. Now, if you actually have an honest-to-goodness vitamin A deficiency, you have true night blindness. You can't see at night. For those of us who hate to drive at night, or you know, you can't really see well when you're driving a vehicle at night, it's what they say is more likely a nearsighted issue than it is a true honest-to-goodness night blindness issue.
I just feel like no one likes driving at night.
Yeah, it's awful.
See, like,
and you're,
you know, I think some people dislike it more, but there's no light. Anything.
And all your visual cues are gone.
Yeah.
If you're by yourself out there, And if you're not used to driving at night, then it's kind of like.
I don't like driving here.
Won't be hauled around. Public transportation, yeah. If we had.
I miss it so much. I don't drive. I don't want to. I've seen the troubles. I'm like, no, it's not.
It's too much trouble, yeah.
Exactly.
All right, so vitamin D is something you can make in your skin in response to sunlight. How else do you get vitamin D into your body?
Milk,
dairy products, good. And why is vitamin D important? Bones, yeah. It actually converts to a hormone that we call calcitriol. And that helps to regulate calcium and phosphorus metabolism in bones. In other words, you need to make your bones strong. And we see that in cases of rickets and osteomalacia where there's a deficiency of vitamin D. Those two problems have weak, soft bones because we're not able to store adequate levels of calcium or phosphorus there. So this is a picture of rickets. We do tend to see this in children that are growing up. Unfortunately, because the bones are weak and soft, the body's weight will cause those bones to bow. I don't mean to indicate that anybody who has bowed legs has rickets, but they do see it as a common thing that occurs with, you know, weight causing those bones to bow. So nowadays, you know, if we can, we can fix this with vitamin D supplements, but some people have simply a vitamin D metabolism disorder, and no amount of supplement's going to help override that metabolism issue. So they may have rickets even if we supplement their vitamin D. Some kids grow like that, yeah. So a pretty severe case there of bowed legs. And then of course later in life, if you have a vitamin D deficiency, then the bones may lose their strength, and this comes from the lack of calcium being deposited there, and so bones will fracture under the body's weight. So ADEC, A, D, E, and K are our fat-soluble vitamins. Vitamin E is next, and this one helps to serve in the immune function role. Now, we do get vitamin E from green leafy vegetables, from oils that we consume, tomatoes and pumpkins, and again, because it's a fat-soluble vitamin, avitaminosis, or lack of this vitamin, tends to be a rare thing. Okay, so if you want to jot down food sources, you can. I'm not going to test you on that on the final exam. It's kind of FYI if you'd like to have it.
So you're
not testing? Oh, not on the food sources, no. I may ask you, like, you know, why is it important or what the deficiency would be for the more common ones, but the food is just for your information. And then finally, vitamin K is also found in green leafy vegetables like spinach and kale. We know it's important for accomplishing blood clotting. That final step of blood clotting is called coagulation, and that forms a more gel-like consistency rather than liquid form for blood. And so vitamin K is involved in making sure that we adequately clot that blood. Now, we do make vitamin K in our intestines, and I did want to show you a link here. If you happen to have, say, an antibiotic regimen that kills your bacteria in your large intestine, how does that impact your ability to make vitamin K? Okay, if you take antibiotics and you kill off the bacteria in your large intestine, how does that impact your vitamin K levels? It lowers them, right. And you know this not by necessarily feeling what's going on in your intestines, but by looking at your skin for what?
Bruises,
exactly. Yeah, so people who can't get enough vitamin K may experience bruising.
Okay, so that's why you sometimes get bruised out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
Is that why some people are easier bruised than others?
It may be, and especially if they take medications that impair blood clotting, that can also increase their bruising.
Are there any other reasons?
Unless we bump ourselves and just don't know it. I do too, especially as a kid, you know, you bump and you didn't realize you bumped.
Every time I go to the pediatrician, he's just always covered in bruises.
They probably assume for little kids, yeah.
Yeah.
Running around.
Jumping off stuff.
Yep. Okay. What are soluble vitamins, or the B and C vitamins? And we don't really store any of them except for vitamin B12. And why is that one important? B12?
RBCs.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And that gives, of course, energy because they transport oxygen. And vitamin C is also one that we can store. It is one that helps us to make collagen fibers. And interesting stuff about vitamin C. Vitamin C is something that other primates can make, but we are unusual in the primate group in that we cannot make our own vitamin C. So, you know, kind of interesting that we have to eat citrus fruits and potatoes to get our vitamin C.
You get scurvy,
that's right. So back in the 1850s, up until about the 1940s, people were experimenting with ways to make foods last longer on the shelf. And by doing this, by giving foods a longer shelf life, then we have seen a lot of vitamin deficiencies come about. In some of these cases, the vitamin deficiencies that were caused by giving food a longer storage life, you know, were not discovered for maybe 40 years after the fact. So this one here, vitamin B1, thiamine, comes from food sources like pork, yeast, and cereals. Well, if you don't have enough vitamin B12, then we influence nervous system functions. Anyone who just doesn't eat enough food, say somebody that has maybe like an alcoholic issue, gastric bypass surgery, may experience a vitamin B1 deficiency. And I want to show you that if you look at any rice products in the grocery store, they will say on there enriched rice. Back, say, in the 1800s, they discovered that, okay, if we remove the husk from the rice that contains the oils, the rice won't spoil, and you can keep it in your cabinets for months without it going bad. Now, unfortunately, in removing the rice husk, which contained those oils, you're also removing the vitamin B1, or thiamine, from that rice grain. So it wasn't something that they realized right away. You know, people started developing disease, and then they said, they started to correlate what had happened, and then they realized, oh, we need to start enriching this rice back with B1 vitamins. So enrichment is required by law in the U.S., so go in the grocery store, pretty much every bag of rice you're going to find there that has the husk removed is going to be enriched back with B1 vitamins. Let's see, there's beriberi disease. It just causes muscle wasting, nervous system deterioration, cardiovascular disease. So ultimately, this can result in death. B2 is riboflavin. Look at all the variety of foods you can get this in. Everything from milk, eggs, and cheese to a lot of vegetarian options like almonds, mushrooms, yeast, legumes. And, you know, I know in the wintertime people get dry skin, and you look at the symptoms here of B2 deficiency and you say, oh my gosh, that's me. But honest to goodness, B2 deficiencies are rare because we're most likely eating some combination of these food groups here. But true dermatitis at the corners of the mouth looks something like this. That looks more than just like dry lips in the wintertime. Now, the reason that B2 deficiencies came about back in the 1800s was because of the way that flour was milled. And again, they found that if they removed the husk around the grain of wheat, that they could keep flour for much longer on the shelf without it going bad and spoiling. And again, you'll notice that all of our flour products in the grocery store are now enriched, and they're enriched with riboflavin, which is vitamin B2. And so that gives us back the vitamin that is robbed from the flour or the wheat grain when they mill this stuff. So pretty interesting why all your food products in the grocery store will say enriched. Yes, why salt is added. We've got something out of everything. B3 is niacin, and it's, again, a common one. We find it in a whole bunch of food groups here, meats and eggs, vegetables, beer, oddly enough. I'm getting my niacin right. Okay, so this particular one is, again, a coenzyme. It's needed in energy reactions. And this time, if a person doesn't have B3, then a disease called pellagra will result. You'll notice that pellagra is characterized by the 4 D's. Dermatitis, or skin inflammation, diarrhea, dementia, and death. So all of these B vitamins are serious business. You know, even though they're not necessarily stored in the body, not having them can result in death.
So we have on beer,
we're all good. Yeah, get your B vitamins, right? This particular issue is one that affects South Carolina particularly. You know, cornmeal, yeah. We South Carolinians love our corn products, you know. And so back in the, I believe it was around 1880, they started milling the corn by removing the corn husk. That's the part that spoils if you store it. And it took until 1937 to start enriching those corn millings. There was about a 40 to 50 year time period in this state where there were a lot of people that developed, you know, pellagra from having had B3 deficiencies. And unfortunately, 50 years is, you know, that's a lifetime for some people, especially if around Spartanburg, they had a lot of people with pellagra, and it took a long time for them to realize, okay, this is yet another grain product that we need to re-enrich with the vitamins. So yeah, again, look at all your corn products in the grocery store. They are enriched back with vitamin B3. All right, so here's some pellagra pictures. So you can see definitely the skin inflammation there. That's the dermatitis portion of pellagra. That's that 4D disease. We know about B9. We know it's a very important one for mothers or potential moms-to-be. This one's also known as folic acid, and it comes from whole grains and cereals. So, you know, if you're eating cereal products, you're probably getting your daily allowance or requirements of vitamin B9. They say that for moms who are in their reproductive years, you know, if you're having sex and the potential for getting pregnant is there, to make sure that you're consuming enough vitamin B9. What is the risk of not having B9 and you get pregnant?
Spina bifida,
right. So, unfortunately, spina bifida can form very early on in the pregnancy, oftentimes before mom knows she's pregnant. And by the time she realizes she's pregnant, that spinal cord has already formed. And if there's B9 deficiencies, then spina bifida can result. And so, yeah, a lot of these whole grain products will often advertise, get your source of folic acid here. So go to the grocery store and walk the cereal aisle. There's a lot of advertisements there for folic acid.
They offer that a lot on
Yeah.
A lot of the cereals that are on there are mostly folate. That's what you need.
Yep. Get that in before you get pregnant. Yeah. The unfortunate thing about spina bifida is it's a preventable birth defect, and babies born with this condition have no motor function below the point of the spinal cord that's affected. So we oftentimes see things like, you know, bladder control, control of feces, leg movement, below the point that that spinal cord has a little piece that pouches out like you see here. So even though they can restore the spinal cord back into the vertebrae, they can't restore the motor function that's lost. We know about B12. We know that B12 is important for red blood cell formation. And we associate B12 with energy because red blood cells transport what?
Oxygen.
Oxygen, good. And without B12, what kind of problems do we run into?
Stomach.
Yeah, and what factor is necessary for the absorption of B12?
Intrinsic factor.
Good, good. And of course, without it, we have pernicious anemia. That is a pretty obnoxious form of anemia because you're looking at inability to make ATP ultimately, not enough oxygen being transported by the low level of red blood cells. I did want to mention, you probably have heard this before, that B12 is only available in animal products. So if you're a vegetarian and you don't consume any animal products, then a B12 supplement may be in order. We actually absorb very little B12 by mouth if you're taking supplements that way. A more effective way to get B12 into your system is through an injection.
So if you are a vegetarian, should
I
take it by mouth?
Actually, they say take an injection. It's more effective than, say, taking oral B12 supplements. We don't absorb all that much from it by mouth.
What about the sublingual ones that you can put in your
tongue? I still think, from what I've heard, they're all, anything by mouth is going to be less absorbed.
Mm-hmm.
It must depend on.
Go
ahead.
Denaturing it or whatever.
Yeah, and probably how much intrinsic factor. It's probably limited by how much you've got in your stomach.
No.
You good? Okay. All right, so vitamin C has an interesting story because back in the 1940s, a man named Linus Pauling did some research, and he came out and said vitamin C is important for immune health. And since the 1940s, there have been a lot of studies done, and all of them have come back and said, you know what, we can't really support his claims that vitamin C is important for immune health. But, you know, what do you have in the grocery store and drugstores? Vitamin C products for immune health, right? You know, you've got these airborne products if you're feeling sick that, you know, take these vitamin C-enriched tablets and they're supposed to make you feel better. I don't know. I mean, maybe there's something there that we haven't yet discovered, but they have not been able to support his claims that vitamin C is actually important for immunity. What we do know is important about vitamin C is its role in making collagen. Collagen is the most abundant protein in our bodies in terms of forming connective tissue structure. And so collagen is very important. We do get it from citrus fruits and from potatoes. So I know you've probably all seen the Pirates of the Caribbean movies. You've seen their gnarly, nasty-looking teeth. And those teeth that fall out are due to collagen fibers that are no longer able to keep the teeth anchored in the head. They have scorbutus or scurvy. Barlow's disease is the other name for it. And that's what happens when your collagen fibers fail.
Yeah. So is that the gums that are like receding?
Receding, yeah.
Okay.
I imagine that does, yeah. Imagine, yeah.
That's why they drink so much rum.
To dull the pain, yeah. They should drink citrus rum if they're going to. If you add, if they're falling out, maybe not, but if you add citrus or some vitamin C supplement back in your body, then you could probably save what hasn't yet been damaged.
Can you take too much vitamin C? Because I drink lemon water like all day. Like I'm addicted to it. I can't drink regular water anymore.
You're probably not getting an excessive amount. You'll store some of it, but you pee it out.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's fine.
Yeah. Okay. If you were getting like injections of vitamin C on top of that, maybe, but.
Okay.
Yeah. Interesting thing about scorbutus, when you've got scurvy, there's little dots that appear on your skin, your tongue. And so this girl is showing the dots that appear. I know everybody's going to go home now and look in the mirror and see if you've got this right. And it also forms little tiny corkscrew hairs because the collagen in the skin is being affected. All right. So just want to give you a rundown. I thought the vitamins are an interesting story for you. Like I mentioned, this chapter is not on your test come Thursday. Not on Thursday yet. There's just a quiz on this chapter. You can take it anytime between now and the 16th of November. And this chapter is going to be on the final exam, but it's a very small number of questions.
The exam is this Thursday.
Can you just do like a quick review of like the big things that you think are going to be on the exam, or
in the risk to hyperventilation, those scenarios?
Yeah, like if we, the hyperventilation is a compensation for acid-base problems, that's a big deal on there.
Okay.
How you breathe, pulmonary ventilation is on there. Yeah, the oxygen hemoglobin dissociation curve is on there. There's two questions. You guys just have to read the chart.
Okay.
The anatomy, I figure you're probably, you've had that in both lecture and lab. You're probably okay.
So you said anatomy, the chart.
Or the other one. That stuff is on there. Okay. And then the oxygen hemoglobin curve is on there.
Okay.
Muscle pressure?
Okay, so you know the anatomy stuff for respiratory. Maybe one or two. I don't know if you haven't really learned a whole lot about them. I wouldn't put a whole lot of time in them at this point. If you start on page 72, those oxygen and CO2 flows at the top of the page are good to know. One of those is a guaranteed essay question. Pulmonary ventilation on page 73, there's a multiple choice on that. There may be an essay on pulmonary ventilation to describe how air is moved in and out. Definitely pages 74 and 75 are both multiple choice and an essay.
What was that? You said 74 and 75,
right? Yeah, 74 and 75, that's hyperventilation, hypoventilation. That's acid-base control. We did talk about partial pressures on 77. You'll want to know the trend, you know, does oxygen move into your body or out of your body? You'll want to know the most common method of transport for both oxygen and CO2. That's found on pages 77 and 78. Let's see, oxygen hemoglobin dissociation curve, you'll want to be able to read one of these charts and predict the percent saturation. There's questions like that over on page 79.
And we'll need to know the factors that influence it either way?
Yeah, know the factors that shift, yeah, left and right.
So all those worksheets that you put online are pretty much everything we need.
Yeah, yeah, those are all good to use to review. Page 80, just want to make a note here that carbon dioxide is transported most commonly as bicarbonate. And that is the number one stimulus for breathing. That's carbon dioxide levels. Okay, so carbon dioxide is transported most commonly as the bicarbonate ion.
But we don't need no carbon monoxide.
I would not worry about carbon monoxide yet.
And that's the most.
Yeah, the number one stimulus for respiration changes is carbon dioxide. Yeah. What I would do for the digestive system is, you know, play word games with yourself. If I said to you intrinsic factor, what organ comes to mind?
Stomach,
and it's needed for vitamin B12. Good. If I said to you hydrochloric acid, what organ comes to mind?
Stomach.
What cells make it?
Parietal.
Good. What hormone tells your stomach to release it?
Gastrin.
Good. What pH results?
One or two,
good. If I said to you, let's see, complete protein hydrolysis and absorption, what organ comes to mind?
Small
intestine, good. If I said to you, defecation reflex, what organ comes to mind?
Large intestine,
good. If I said villi, microvilli, circular folds?
Small intestine.
And the purpose of those?
Absorb
nutrients, good. Increasing
surface area,
good. If we talked about no absorptive function,
large intestine.
That could be large intestine. It also could be No absorption.
No absorption.
Esophagus. Yeah. If we talked about Acini cells, you would think about.
Oh.
Acini cells. A-C-I-N-I. Pancreas. Yeah, pancreas. So when you're studying, I would think about key terms. Let that trigger a organ or a process. And I would think about each organ and what it contributes to the process of digestion and absorption. In terms of pancreas, liver, gallbladder, I would think about what they contribute. What kind of secretions do they make? How do hormones control those secretions? That's another good thing to think about. What are the two hormones that stimulate the liver, pancreas, and gallbladder to secrete fluids into the intestines?
Secretin.
Yep, CCK and secretin.
Yeah.
Okay, so like I said earlier, metabolism's not on this test. It does show up on the final, but not on this third test.
And tests are due by 8
a.m. The quizzes will close at 9:30. Yeah, on Thursday.
Okay.
Any topics I can hit for you? Sure. The thing to remember is O for obstructive is O for out. So if I can't exhale out, I have an obstructive disorder. And COPD. Bronchitis, asthma, emphysema fall in that category. So the restrictive disorders are ones that you can't breathe in for. Those are things like pulmonary fibrosis. We didn't really talk a whole lot on those. So I mainly focus on obstructive means you can't breathe in. Probably have restrictive. Any other topics I can help y'all with?
Can you just tell us what's
happening?
Yeah. Okay. I'll just let it be online, or
we
can say
how. That would be easy, wouldn't it?
Okay, so essay, pathways.
Pathway page 72.
Pulmonary ventilation and digestive.
Digestive stuff, it may be involving like, you know, breaking something, if something doesn't work, look at CCK and secretin.
Okay, so not really.
Flow. Yeah, the flow for digestive, yes, we did, yeah, in labs. So I didn't
okay,
lecture.
Okay.
Yeah. Y'all good? If you need anything, email me. Come by and see me. I'm in my office for class on Thursday.
Oh,